This session is being taped, and if people have any problems with that as we get into some discussion, let me know. And I don't know if that, what'll happen in the tape room if I say, let's stop it, but I assume that then it won't get reproduced into other tapes, so. Someone may hear it today, but probably wouldn't hear it after today. My name is Carol Witte, and I'm a nurse practitioner in Seattle with Group Health Cooperative, and tonight I'm talking about sexually transmitted diseases, and the title that I gave to this is Sexist Diseases, because they are sexist diseases. They affect women far more than they affect men, and that's why I kind of wanted to do this as a woman-only session. I've had a number of men come up to me and ask me if we're doing one on, for both women and men, and someone also suggested that earlier this summer the staff could have used a session on this for both women and men, but apparently he thought the problem was less severe at this point in time. I don't know what that means, but anyway, so I am just doing it for women tonight, and I want to talk a little bit about some of the effects of sexually transmitted diseases on women, talk a little bit about the connection with sexually transmitted diseases and HIV infection, and then talk about some ways of promoting safer sex, and have brought, as I like to do, my little gizmos here for us to look at and play with and whatever. And then I want to talk about an interesting art exhibit that was at Harvard University last year. And then if there's time, I want to get into a group, couple, well, I was going to say small group discussion, but it's that sort of, there are a couple different discussion questions that I have about sexually transmitted disease and about safer sex promotion. I thought we could maybe discuss those. We could certainly do that as one large group, as we seem to be one small group, even as a large group. So, well, first of all, to talk about some of the consequences, I'm not going to go through and do sort of statistical stuff on every sexually transmitted disease, because you can probably get that any number of places and it gets sort of boring. So, but I am going to talk about the sexually transmitted diseases that seem to affect women more than men, and some of the things to kind of watch for on these things out in the world. First of all, the consequence that probably affects women and that we're most concerned about with sexually transmitted diseases, other than the connection with HIV, is PID, or pelvic inflammatory disease. That is something that's usually caused by a sexually transmitted disease organism, either chlamydia or gonorrhea. It can be caused by other organisms that are not sexually transmitted, but we usually associate it with sexually transmitted disease organisms. And there are 1 million cases a year of PID in the United States, and by age 35, 15% of all American women have had a case of PID. If you don't know what this is, basically what it is there's an infection that affects the fallopian tubes. And as you can see, the fallopian tubes on my incredibly bad drawing up there are the connection between the ovaries and the uterus. So if you're going to get pregnant, the ovum or the has to be able to pass from the ovary through the fallopian tube down into the uterus to implant. And if there is an infection in the fallopian tubes at some time in your lifetime, if that infection then turns into scar tissue in your fallopian tubes, what that can mean is a problem with infertility. You can either block your fallopian tubes completely with scar tissue, or you can block them just enough that the egg actually gets stuck in the fallopian tube. You can have what's called an ectopic pregnancy, where the egg gets stuck there, starts developing as it would in the uterus, and then at a certain point, usually about 6 to 8 weeks in the pregnancy, can actually rupture the fallopian tube. In the worst case scenario, that can cause death. In the not-so-bad case scenario, it can cause you an extreme amount of pain, internal bleeding, or severe infections, which you can be hospitalized for. It needs to be treated surgically, and it's considered a medical emergency if you have an ectopic pregnancy. So as you can see, if there are a million cases of this a year, and if it's potentially affecting women's fertility in this way, it's a pretty serious consequence of a sexually transmitted disease. The one that we're most concerned about right now is a disease called chlamydia. It's a bacterial infection that is very insidious. It's a nasty little organism because it doesn't make people very sick. So most people have absolutely no idea that they have it. They don't come in to see their doctor or nurse practitioner because they have symptoms, because usually they don't have any symptoms. We see it mostly in young women in their late teens, early 20s, who have, say, more than 2 or 3 sexual partners in a year. What happens is you get this from a sexual partner, and it causes frequently a very scar-producing infection in your fallopian tubes that may not give you any symptoms. If you have some symptoms, you may have some abdominal pain. You can occasionally have some discharge. But most frequently you have no symptoms at all, and not necessarily even something that we can see when you come in for your exam. You know, frequently we don't see anything there that looks abnormal or abnormal enough that we would suspect something. More and more practitioners are screening for this in all young women who are sexually active, and that it's a test that's only recently been good enough to really be used on a wide basis. It's only been in the last, I don't know exactly how long the test's been available, but we figure chlamydia has been around for a very long time. We just haven't had the tools to be able to pick it up. We do know that it's definitely on the rise, and that we are concerned about young women's fertility, and we think that may have something to do with what we see the increasing amount of infertility in this society has probably something to do with this chlamydia infection.
And I can tell you that in 1982 the test mm-hmm. wasn't very good, mm-hmm. and that you still had to use the liquid and stuff.
Right.
You had the ELISA test. Right. So probably since about 1985 we've had something that's been fairly handy.
Handy, right.
And in the Indian Health Service now, a woman comes in for a pelvic exam, she gets the whole schmear. She gets the chlamydia, she gets the gonorrhea. Even though gonorrhea isn't all that common, like say in the Navajo Nation. Mm-hmm. She doesn't get the syphilis test anymore though, because that's still right. kind of on the back. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So we do test, as I said, women that we consider may probably be at high risk. If you're young and sexually active, we'll test you for it. If you're positive, it's relatively easy to treat this disease. We treat it with a course of antibiotics. And we treat partners. We can test partners as well. We don't as often pick it up from male partners. Males have the great ability to get rid of a lot of these organisms, as most of the sexually transmitted diseases get passed through the same orifice as urine gets passed through, and women don't have that same ability. We have like the world's greatest growing incubator for all kinds of bugs, which is another reason why women are more affected by sexually transmitted diseases. We can treat, as I said, it takes about a week of antibiotic therapy, and sometimes, depending on how reliable we think you are with your medication, we will see you back again in about 2 weeks to test you to see if the infection's gone. But the problem is we never know how much scarring has occurred, and we don't know when it's occurred. One of the worst case scenarios in my office is I'll see a woman, she hasn't been sexually active for 6 months or so. I do a screening test. She has chlamydia. The question is, how long has this been sitting in there? How much damage has been done? And you know, the research on this varies widely. I've read some reports that say with each additional case of chlamydia, if someone has multiple cases of chlamydia through their life, they maybe lose 10% of their fertility each time they have this infection. But then there are also cases where people can get severe scarring with just one case of chlamydia. And so it's one of those things that's real scary to deal with and real scary for people to have. And it's something that can be pretty easily screened for if we're watching people carefully. Certainly if you have any abnormal discharge or pelvic pain, if you've been with a questionable partner, or if you have friends or family members who have been with questionable partners, certainly come in and get tested for chlamydia. But that is one of the ones that we worry about a lot with women. Gonorrhea will also do the same thing, but usually people get pretty sick with gonorrhea and have some kind of yucky discharge, and we know that something's going on. That doesn't always happen with chlamydia. The other two, I started talking about pelvic inflammatory disease. I was going to talk about the other consequences of some of the sexually transmitted diseases. Premature delivery, if you're pregnant, if you get a sexually transmitted disease while you're pregnant, can cause a premature delivery. The estimates are that 8% of all live births are associated, premature births are associated with sexually transmitted diseases that have brought people into labor earlier. Of course, that puts the baby at greater risk. If they're born early, they have all the problems that are associated with prematurity. Also, some of these diseases can cause spontaneous abortions, one particular sexually transmitted disease can cause cancer of the cervix. We talked about that a little bit. That's the human papillomavirus, or HPV, or genital warts. We now think that most cases of cervical cancer are associated with the HPV virus. Not necessarily, I don't know that there are too many people who are willing to say it definitely causes cervical cancer, but we do know that there is a very close association, and some researchers are saying it does cause cervical cancer.
Another point though, mm-hmm. there is no cervical cancer without tobacco smoke.
Right, and I'm going to bring that up in just a minute.
Great.
So, yep. And toxic shock sometimes can also be affected by more organisms involved in sexually transmitted diseases. And herpes, what we're worried about there is causing what's called herpes encephalitis in a newborn baby. If you have herpes, especially if you have your primary outbreak of herpes at the time you're delivering a baby, it increases the baby's risk for developing a brain infection caused by the herpes virus, which can be fatal to the baby. So those are the things we worry about the most. I'm going to mostly talk about, we talked about chlamydia, I'm mostly going to talk about the viral sexually transmitted diseases, because they're the ones that we can't treat. They're the ones that people will have for the rest of their lives, and they're the ones that are hardest to prevent, and I think they're the ones that women need to know the most about. The first one is the human papillomavirus, which I mentioned briefly. It's a virus. It causes warts. Any wart you have on your body is caused by a human papillomavirus. Papilloma just means wart. So one of the human papillomavirus will cause the planter's warts or the warts you have on your hand. There are about 60 different types of wart virus. There are about 5 types that prefer the genital area and will only grow in the genital area. Of those 5 types, there are 2 that we closely associate with the development of cervical cancer. We, at this point, are not sure that the kind that cause visible warts on the outside is also the same that causes the cervical cancer, but we are concerned that if you've got visible warts on the outside, the likelihood is that you've also been exposed to the kind that cause more or less invisible warts but do bring you at more risk for cervical cancer. Does that make any sense?
The outside is what?
The outside of your genital area.
Oh,
no, outside. Genital area. Okay. So we're talking labia and just right around the opening of the vagina. That's where we see it frequently in women. On men, we see it on the head of the penis. And the problem with the wart virus is that if you get exposed to the wart virus, you may or may not ever have any symptoms. Some people get asymptomatic infections of the wart virus, which means that you may not ever have a wart that you can see. And the only way we may know that you've been affected by this virus is that we may see a change in your pap smear. One of the problems with this, and this is what I say about all sexually transmitted diseases, I put guys into about 3 categories. They're the guys that know they have things and are jerks and they pass it along to women. Okay? They're the guys who, if they thought about it enough, they would probably figure out that they probably have something, but they kind of will never like think about it enough to even know. So they aren't completely jerks, but they just haven't thought about it enough. And then there are wonderful, trustworthy, in every other respect, great guys who have absolutely no idea that they're carrying these things. Now I'm talking here completely about heterosexual transmission. Some of these viruses can also be passed back and forth from female to female sex, lesbian sex. But we have very little research about that, partly because the lesbian community has chosen not to be very open frequently with physicians, and it's hard to do research in the lesbian community. But some of these things can be passed back and forth female to female. We see it a lot more in male to female transmission, however. So, you know, basically with the wart virus, you need to be asking partners whether or not they've ever had a wart or if they've ever had some funny little bump on their penis. They may never have had one, and they may never know that they have had one. If they know that a previous partner, for example, had had an abnormal pap smear, you know, that's one of the things that you can ask. Because if previous partners had an abnormal pap smear, the likelihood is that they either gave them the wart virus or they now carry that wart virus and could potentially carry it on to you. And so that's a difficult thing. Part of the problem with the wart virus is, even if we treat the visible warts, they always have the potential for coming back. Warts will usually go away by themselves in about a year's time. They tend to be pretty self-limiting, but that has nothing to do with whether or not the virus is still in your system. The virus will be in your system for the rest of your life if you ever contract this virus. And there is nothing that we can do at this point to get rid of it. It will just always be there. What we do is watch you to make sure that your pap smears don't become very abnormal and potentially get you closer to having a cervical cancer. That is not a foregone conclusion. In other words, if you have warts, there's no way that anyone can tell you whether or not what your chances are of ending up with cervical cancer. If you have a pap smear every year and that stays normal, I'd basically consider yourself safe, but I would go in and have a pap smear every year. If you have visible warts, you can have those treated if you want. A lot of people choose to do that for cosmetic reasons. They don't like the way they look. but it probably doesn't even change how infectious you are. You can probably still pass that virus on even if you have visible warts. So the treatments aren't pleasant. It's usually burning it off with some kind of freezing or acid, and you have to come back weekly for treatment. If you have friends who have had these, you know how difficult it is. They have to come in all the time, and we constantly try and zap those warts and get them to go away. But again, they will usually go away by themselves within a year's time. They will get worse during pregnancy. They feed off of estrogen. They love estrogen, so pregnant women who have warts tend to get big, nasty-looking ones. They aren't really going to hurt anything, but they will be there. The other thing about the wart virus that the woman who left alluded to is that when women smoke, they have more problems with the wart virus. One of the reasons is that your vagina is this amazing organism that concentrates the poisons in cigarettes 7 times more in your vaginal secretions than any place else in your body. So if a person smokes 1 cigarette, it's like their vagina is smoking 7. And so you can imagine that all the toxins in the cigarettes really aggravate any kind of ongoing condition in your vagina and will make that worse, and it does. People who stop smoking, I use this often as a way to get patients to stop smoking if they have problems with warts. And when they stop smoking, they stop having as much problem with the warts. So it's a great tool in my arsenal to get people off of cigarettes, but other than that, it's not so great. The other virus that really affects women quite a bit is the herpes virus. And unfortunately, the herpes virus is very much like the wart virus in the fact that once you've got it, you'll have it the rest of your life. You can pass it on even when you have no visible symptoms. And that's new for a lot of people. The information that we had up until a few years ago was that if you got herpes, you were only contagious at the time that you had an open sore or right before you had an open sore when you had what we call a prodrome, when you'd have kind of a tingling in that area. We now no longer believe that because we know that a lot of people get herpes from who knows where. They have absolutely no idea where they got it from. They probably got it from a completely asymptomatic partner, someone who had an outbreak of herpes but had absolutely no idea they had it. They never feel it enough to associate it with something like herpes. There are interesting stories told, like a guy who comes in, has an obvious herpes lesion. His doctor says to him, "Well, do you know that you have herpes?" And he said, "Oh no, I just caught it in my zipper." He said, "Well, how often do you catch yourself in your zipper?" "Oh, about twice a year." Well, it's a herpes lesion that he never recognized as a herpes lesion. He just thought that twice a year he caught himself in his zipper and he always had this little open sore and it didn't bother him very much. Never thought of it as herpes. So it can be something like that, or it can be something that people really have absolutely no idea. They don't feel it. I mean, there could be a sore that you get in one area of your labia and it just sort of seems to come back, but it doesn't bother you very much, so you don't think very much about it. Potentially it could be herpes. There are some blood tests available now that we can test people for herpes to test in your body for antibody to the herpes virus. What that means is that if you've been exposed to the herpes virus, your body will develop a defense against that virus, and we can test for that antibody to see whether or not you have herpes 1, which is oral herpes, or herpes 2. They've done some tests over broad spectrums of normal, healthy people and found that 70% of the American population tests positive for the antibody to herpes 1, oral herpes. We think we probably get it from kindly old aunts who give us kisses when we're babies. I mean, it comes from somebody, but probably, you know, no one means to pass on herpes, but it's real easy to do oral herpes. Genital herpes, about 24% of the population carries antibodies to genital herpes. Probably 10% of the population has symptoms. So there is a group of people out there that, again, have absolutely no idea that they're carrying it and can still pass it on. So that's the bad news about the viruses. They are working on vaccines for these things, but I'm afraid that they're a long way off. So, and then the final one that we, of course, all worry about is HIV. That is something that is definitely on the rise in women. Currently in the New York City area, AIDS is the leading cause of death for women between the ages of 23 and 34. Now, obviously, the population in New York City is probably a little different than the population in this room. We're talking a lot more IV drug using people and a lot more people whose partners are IV drug using, and that's probably where a lot of this AIDS is coming from in New York City. But it is on the rise in sort of what we consider white middle-class American women, and it is something to be concerned about. the other thing I was going to say about this. There are a couple of good books that are out about HIV for women. And I'm just going to read you the little quotes from the review on each one of these, which I think are helpful information. The one book talks about facing the risks without engendering the helplessness that discussions of HIV frequently invoke. I haven't read either of these books, but they have been highly recommended to me. One is called Making It, A Woman's Guide to Sex in the Age of AIDS. And the other one is Women and AIDS. And that one talks about that the hope that in the era of AIDS, this will be an empowering for women as a new sexual consciousness awakens based on increased communication and mutual responsibility between partners. They're both obviously trying to look at the optimistic aspect of this, is that we'll be more open and honest with our partners in an attempt to try and stop the spread of the HIV virus. I don't have exact statistics on how many people are contracting AIDS. We still think that most of the people who contract it probably second or third hand from those people that we still think are high risk. Gay or bisexual men or IV drug using partners. The difficulty is the old adage of, you know, when you have sex with someone, you're having sex with everybody they've ever had sex with. What our current recommendations are for women, and it seems sort of extreme, is that when you first start a relationship, you get tested for the AIDS virus. It does take, let me just go back and talk about the testing for HIV a little bit. Probably many of you are aware of this. When you get tested for the HIV virus, whatever your results on the day that you get your blood test results, it means that 6 months ago, that was what your HIV status was. It can take your body as long as 6 months to develop the antibody to the AIDS virus. So in other words, if I test you today, it doesn't tell me anything about the last 6 months. If you've been with a questionable partner in the last 6 months, the test today doesn't mean anything. It will tell you that 6 months ago you were okay if it was negative. So we suggest at the beginning of a relationship to get tested, both partners get tested for HIV, and then they use condoms and monogamy for the next 6 months. And I'm aware that there are a lot of relationships out there that don't last 6 months, but what that means is that you use condoms for 6 months or until the relationship ends, and then you get tested again at the end of that time. If you're still with that same partner and you've been practicing monogamy and using condoms, you can be pretty assured that at the beginning of the relationship you were HIV negative, and you probably still are if you were monogamous and using condoms. And at that point, we suggest that it's okay to stop using condoms, and if you have any concerns about these other viral sexually transmitted diseases, the warts or the herpes, we can't do any tests for those per se, but with those two, at that point, probably in your relationship, you're ready to talk about whether or not you're willing to take the risk of getting that particular disease from someone, and how you feel about getting warts or herpes from someone, and whether or not they think any of their partners have ever had that. So could they be an asymptomatic carrier? I frequently feel when I talk with women who are just starting a new relationship or who have just ended a relationship and are worried about meeting new people, that I should hand them about a 600-page manual on how to have sex in the 90s. It gets to be a kind of depressing topic. And all I can say is that you need to pick your partners carefully. I would certainly advise monogamy if that's at all possible. I know that that's not a reality for a lot of people. And I do caution women, especially about serial monogamy. A lot of young women have what we call serial monogamous relationships. You're just with one person, but then that relationship's end, and then you're just with another person, and then that relationship ends, and then you're just with another person. It's very easy in those kind of serially monogamous relationships that are not very long-term to pick up some of these viruses, because a lot of people have them. And so you just have to be real careful and real open and try to talk through a lot of the stuff with your partner. What I usually try to encourage people to do is try and do some role plays with their friends or with the mirror, and sort of talk about the kind of questions that you want to ask in a new relationship situation. So that's kind of my short spiel here. I did want to just give you one little international perspective on this, which is a pretty sad one. When we talk about HIV in particular in women in the third world, a real frequent scenario there is that many women are separated from their sexual partners, from their husbands, because of employment issues, that the women live one place and the men have to work someplace very far away. And in those situations, it's real frequent that women end up with a sexually transmitted disease because their partner has another sexual partner away from them, or has more than one sexual partner away from them. They come home, bring them a sexually transmitted disease. They get something like gonorrhea or chlamydia. They end up being unable to have children because of it. Because they can't have children in those kind of cultures, what happens frequently is those women are divorced or abandoned, end up in prostitution, and that's where we see a lot of the rise of HIV in a lot of third world countries. And the other part of it is that we're seeing a lot of orphans as the result of HIV in third world countries, that both parents die, perhaps the child lives, but then ends up in street life and then maybe in prostitution. So we still aren't beginning to be affected the way the third world countries are by these problems. But I think it's real important for us to be aware of them and be aware of how much they do affect women. So, let's see. The other thing I wanted to do, I was going to pass around some of my little things here again, like I always do. Here's what I promised last night, the 8x10 glossy photograph of the female condom, which is about to be introduced. I'll pass this around for you. The name of this is called Reality. They did a test survey with a bunch of women, and the women responded that they thought Reality was the best name because this is reality in the 90s. Guys don't always use condoms, and if you want to be safe, maybe you need to be using a condom. So you can read some of the statistics on the back. They're probably due to be out sometime this fall. They're put into the vagina sort of like a diaphragm. This part is folded up and pushed up into the vagina. This part actually hangs outside the vagina, and that's one of the complaints that people have had with it. In reality, this may be one of the things that make it very safe, and that will probably lessen the kind of skin-to-skin contact that may cause herpes or the wart virus, if there's a little bit of protection outside covering part of the labia. So you can look for this on the market. I'm sure it will get a lot of press when it comes out. This is a little gizmo here on how to use a condom. Part of the problem with sexually transmitted diseases is even if people decide they're going to use condoms, a lot of people don't know how to use them correctly. So I do have a lot of condoms here. In fact, I probably have one for everybody. If everybody wants one of these, I can pass these around too. And one of the things that people are always amazed at with these are all unlubricated, so they're not the kind I recommend buying, but they're the kind I recommend if you're going to be demonstrating different condoms here, because no one likes that gook all over their hands. So one person, and this may not be something you need to hear, but if you're ever talking to someone who's younger or more concerned about using condoms and afraid of them or afraid of what partners are going to say about them, teenage boys frequently say that they can't use condoms because they're too big. I mean, the condoms are too small. They couldn't possibly get one of these on. And so what you can do is you can buy a nice unlubricated condom, and I can't do this very well, but you can pull it down and you can actually fit it over your entire arm. And you can show it to them and say, well, gosh, that's just too bad. Because it's very unlikely that they're going to be too small for anybody. So it's always a fun sort of party game. Yeah, right, exactly. So anyway, that's always one surefire party game that works well here. But these are a different variety. People want to take them out and play with them and look at them. I do recommend using lubricated condoms, and especially lubricated condoms with spermicide on them. And actually, this is the one that I recommend mostly to my patients. It's called the Mentor condom. It's really gunky, but I'll show it to you here. It has, number one, it comes with an applicator, so it's almost impossible to get it on incorrectly. Probably the biggest problem with putting on condoms is people put them on and then realize they're on backwards, so they take them off and they put them on again. Well, by that time, they've already got some of the seminal fluid, the little bit of wetness that's on the end of the penis, on the end of the condom when they put it on. So already they've got something there they can be giving you either. That's where we know that there's a large concentration of HIV fluid in that pre-ejaculate, the fluid that comes out before a man ejaculates. So it is important not to do that, not to put it on, take it off, and turn it over again. This one has an applicator, so it's almost impossible to get it on wrong. And it rolls down like this. And then what it does, this isn't a very good model here, my thumb isn't long enough. It has adhesive on the bottom of the condom, around the base of the condom. And what that does is, that's the other place where a lot of leakage occurs with condoms, is that after ejaculation, when a man loses his erection, if the condom isn't withdrawn, if the penis and condom aren't withdrawn or held in place at that point in time, that's when you can get some seepage of some of the semen out of a condom. And so with this one, because it does have, and it really doesn't show up very well here in my finger, but because it does have some adhesive, it's not like super glue, it's not going to be hard to get this thing off, but it is going to keep it in place for as long as you want it kept in place. They are more expensive than the regular condoms. They cost about, I think it's about $1 a piece. And the name of them, I have another one here, I guess I don't. It's Mentor Condom. You can look at this and pass this around.
Why does it say mint? Is that like color?
It's the mint-like flavor.
Oh.
So the other nice thing about this little applicator that comes with these is that another place that a lot of people have problems with condoms is that they rip them when they're, because the condom is inside this applicator, you can't rip it when you're ripping open the package. And the other thing is, you can't hurt it when it's being applied, when it's being put on a penis. It's not, you're not going to rip it or tear it with your fingers or anything as it's being put on, because this thing's there and you pull that off and then the condom's there. It is an extra piece of stuff to throw away, but anyway. Oh, I forgot to bring my paper towels. The other thing I'm going to pass, let me pass this around. This is about instructions on how to use it. The other side of this talks about places where cities that are doing condom distribution in high school, cities where they're doing condom distribution in prisons, and also a little bit about correct use of condoms. And you can look at both sides of that.
Condoms in prisons?
Yeah, there's a lot of homosexual activity in prisons, and a lot of people in prison are HIV positive, and so it, you know, if they can't buy condoms there, it means putting those people who are not HIV positive when they enter prison at pretty high risk. Not to say that people are going to use them.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking, I wondered how much of the homosexual activity was somewhat forced.
Yeah, I think a lot of it's forced.
I can't imagine if, you know, it's forced. Well, why don't you put this on?
Right, exactly. And I think that's true. I think the idea is that if there is some homosexual activity that's not forced, then at least they can be trying to prevent it in some, to some degree. But I agree. I mean, that's not solving the problem. Yeah, unfortunately. This is the article. Well, let's do this instead first. Dental dams. Here's another thing that everybody wants to know about.
We get them at school.
Did you hear about
yeah.
it at school? Because most of my patients have never heard of them, never seen them.
Well, they give them. Us a wellness kit.
Uh-huh.
Freshman.
And they give you a dental dam.
Yeah,
that's
kind of a big joke, though.
Yeah, nobody uses them. No.
I
don't think so. Dental dams. This is something dentists use. You probably have them used in your mouth. They kind of help occlude. They'll push your tooth through part of this and then hold the rest of it down to keep your tongue out of the way. Well, these are made out of latex, just like condoms are, and the suggested use for these is to be used during oral sex if it's not mouth-to-penis contact. If it's mouth-to-penis contact, the penis should have a condom on it. So any other kind of oral genital sex, the suggestion is that this is used on the genital area or in the mouth when that contact is going on. Now, most people go, oh, you've got to be kidding me when they hear about this. The reality is, we do not know of any cases of people contracting HIV from oral sex only. We do know that you can pass herpes. You can pass oral herpes to the genital area, and you can pass genital herpes to the oral area. So I usually tell my patients, this, I feel like this is probably more important for herpes, and it may also help you with HIV. I have frankly not heard of very many people that use it, but this is something that we may have to think about more in the future. So I'll pass these around here, and you can read that as well. Is there any other things here? I talked last night about different kinds of spermicide, and again, because spermicide can be helpful in decreasing the amount of sexually transmitted disease, And so I have a couple different examples of spermicide. I've got foam up here. Last night I showed this stuff, which is films, contraceptive film, which melts in the vagina. You can place this in the vagina and it'll melt, and I can pass that around. I think a lot of you have seen it last night, though. Anything else I can think of? Okay, well, this is my favorite part. This little guy right here, this is a sculpture made out of condoms that represents what was his position? C. Everett Koop, the former Surgeon General of the United States. There was a woman who's a psychiatrist, actually, who made this whole art exhibit, which is going to be touring the country at some time in the future, about condoms, and did different things with them. And I'll pass this around. You can read the article if you want. But she entitled the exhibit Sacred Condoms, and basically she did it as a way of trying to make condoms less scary, less medical, less intimidating, so that people could feel more free and open with them. And she entitled it Sacred Condoms because she did feel that because condoms can save people's lives, that they are sacred and should be regarded as that. It happened at Harvard Divinity School, and they actually had a blessing of the condoms service where they passed around condoms. The guy that led the service, and you know, this makes sense, he's worked with a lot of HIV patients, a lot of people who have died of AIDS, and said that if one of these condoms could have saved one of those people's lives, that he felt that it was life-giving and it's something that you know, is something that we should honor and respect. I mean, I certainly think they're a useful tool. I guess I'm not quite ready to have a blessing of the condom service here at Holden, but that's one idea here.
One of our campus pastors, he's going to have this kind of joke. He was talking about this party, mm-hmm. and he called it Blessing of the Prophylactics, something else than Blessing of the Prophylactics. Mm-hmm. It's kind of funny. I mean, mm-hmm. never happened.
Right. But I think, you know, more and more, I think especially for women in college, I imagine that you get a lot of sex education and STD protection education, and I think that that's great. I think the problem is the places where that's not happening, and those school districts I get especially concerned about that are having these huge uproars about condom distribution in the schools and wondering sort of what happens to the education of those kids. The discussion questions that I had were different ones here, and we can discuss all of these or none of these or whatever. But people have certainly proposed doing sex education in schools. Some of the different ideas that have been proposed have been abstinence-only training, where that's the only thing you teach is abstinence. Other people have said that that's kind of ridiculous and you need to look at abstinence-based training so that what you're suggesting to the kids and teaching them is, you know, how it is possible to be abstinent and how it is possible to use other forms of expression to be intimate, but also to recognize that that's not always going to happen. Condom distribution, I want to read you a little blurb about a program that was tried. It wasn't tried specifically to lower the number of sexually transmitted diseases, but it was tried to lower the number of teenage pregnancies. And it was an interesting program with interesting results. Where is my name? In a rural school district, there was a community-based program by schools, clergy, parents, and media to focus on decision-making and communication skills, issues of self-esteem, personal values, and sex education. And the idea was especially to empower adolescent women by enhancing their self-esteem and sense of control over their lives. And they reduced their teenage pregnancy rate. When they started, before the program, was 60 per 1,000 students. And at the end of 3 years, they reduced that to 25 per 1,000 students. And talking about doing it as a broad-based community effort, not something that's just done by the schools, but doing it together with churches. And that's why one of the things up here is to potentially talk about how is that possible to do in churches. And certainly it would vary from congregation to congregation widely. But we, you know, a lot of the criticism of the school-based programs is you're teaching kids personal values and the school's not the place to be doing that. The family should be doing that. Well, if the family's not doing that, and in many cases the family's not doing that, and if we're talking about values, should we maybe be doing some of this in the churches and having these kind of discussions in churches? Should we be doing condom distribution in churches?
I personally think that it would be great to be doing some of this stuff in churches, and then certainly from congregation to congregation, it's going to vary how much they're ready for and how much they can deal with. But certainly the idea of self-esteem training, decision-making and communication skills, and helping people clarify their values, I think all of those things certainly have, there's a place for that kind of stuff in the churches. And then the last question is, at Holden, as far as I know, the only place condoms are available here are from the nurse, and I'm not even sure that they're available from her. There's been some discussion about selling them in the store, and that's been basically vetoed by directors and boards at various times in Holden's history, because they certainly don't want to give the impression that there's all kinds of unbridled sexual activity going on here. And I'm not going to suggest that that's happening, but I also know there are a lot of people at an age where outside of Holden they would be likely to be quite sexually active, and my guess is that they probably are quite sexually active at Holden. And if there's no place for people to get condoms here, I mean, it's not like you can run down to the drugstore and buy them, you know, there's just no place to get them. And so should there be condom distribution here, and how should that be handled? Should it be in the store? Should it be just through the nurse? Should it be in the bathrooms of the staff lodges? Should it be in the bathrooms of the guest lodges? And one of the problems people have talked about is the disposal of condoms. If they were put in the toilet, would they clog up the sewer system, which is always a big problem for things at Holden? And if they aren't put in the toilets, are the garbology teams going to have to go through all these condoms? So, I mean, there are some, you know, realistic questions here. So, yeah, another bucket. I think that's the answer. Women have to put their sanitary supplies in a particular bucket, so why can't the guys put their condoms in? Of course, they're not. I don't know, so these are the possible things that we could discuss, and I don't know if anybody has any thoughts or comments about any of this or about any of the other stuff that passed around. Mm-hmm. Has anybody worked in a situation where they've worked with school-based programs, or you've had them in your colleges but you haven't, who does that, who organizes those kind of? So it's like
student groups, mm-hmm. on campus.
Anytime, yeah. You go into the health center, this is my experience, like, going in for a cold, you end up getting condoms. I mean, they just like
throw them at you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They have a week, awareness mm-hmm. weeks where they push it, and they have mm-hmm. topics all week and signs everywhere.
There's a big thing where they gave these packs of condoms out, and they're like, I don't know, like 12 different kinds, and people are supposed to try them and rate them, and have this like
article written.
On which ones came in with the best ratings, and then they do a lot of stuff.
And that, what school is that?
Western.
At Western? Okay.
One thing I'm always amazed about is, you know, the big ruckus in the high schools about mm-hmm. the education. I went to a private Catholic school, and we had STD contraceptive training.
Did you? That's amazing.
Education. I mean, we also read any book that was banned anywhere. I mean, but Catholic Jesuits, I mean, that's just what they did.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't a big deal, and that's just how they did things. So I'm always amazed when I see the public schools where it is this big ethical issue. I guess we'll have to go to Catholics to learn these things.
to learn about this stuff. That is surprising. That is interesting. I'm sure there are Catholic schools where it's not done, but...
Yeah. But I guess in the Jesuits, they
yeah, right. Has anyone had experience with this in the high school at all? Know what things are happening in a high school in your area, or if this issue's been broached at all, or what they're doing with condom distribution? Anybody close to high school stuff?
Everything was vetoed in our town.
What town is that?
Bellingham, mm-hmm. a small town. Everything was vetoed. They had a group of students that sort of rebelled against that and tried to hand out condoms, mm-hmm. and that lasted about couple hours,
mm-hmm.
and then they. Yeah.
We had some discussion, or I didn't, but the church in church.
Uh huh. About whether or not the school should be doing.
No, they. Well, Mike, being pastor, and then the youth leaders talked to the youth group about AIDS, about sexual values
mm-hmm.
during their youth. Time, so.
Mm-hmm. Do you know of other churches that are doing that, or the congregation that I go to has like nobody in high school, so I don't, you know, it hasn't
yeah.
been an issue in our congregation, but so I'm just curious to know how other congregations are handling that.
I sure don't know. I thought that was pretty bold of them, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
But the parents all were, you know, a lot of the parents were, they were really participating because they felt the children would be
intimidated. Yeah.
But, you know, they were in the decision-making process to have it.
Mm-hmm. And that's the one thing I do see a potential problem in having it in the church is that the kids would feel too much like that's somebody watching over them. Where in school it seems a little bit more anonymous. But then that's the problem the parents have with it. They don't want sort of that kind of anonymous teaching going on.
So you were mainly focusing on birth control for people who haven't made a choice of whether or not to have permanent birth control. You weren't ever going to go into sterilization here today.
No.
That wasn't the focus.
Mm-mm. No, I was just talking about sexually transmitted diseases, so not about birth control stuff today.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm a youth group leader in Bellingham at this kind of small country church. And I had pretty much full reign to talk about, to plan, do whatever I wanted with this group. And the pastor would, you know, pop in with smile. And when that, we were talking about, we started just relationship kind of stuff. And we got into sex, and some parents got really mad, and they came up to me, and they just thought that I should have approached the board first, and da, 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 da. And you know, we were, I was just discussing the questions that they brought up, and I wasn't giving any answers or anything, but it was just funny to see how anything else was okay, but
not sex.
This, and they were quite mad.
Mm-hmm. And you know, that's what scares me, I think, the most, is because of the rise in sexually transmitted disease, and I think especially we're so afraid to acknowledge, you know, who's having sex and at what age. And it's really the younger people are that when they start having sex, the more at risk they are for all of these sexually transmitted diseases, not to mention pregnancy. And, you know, it seems like only when the adults kind of can get over their inability to talk about this and the inability to face the reality of what's going on with their kids that, you know, we're going to... And I just hope that there's not an AIDS epidemic first among... Mm-hmm. young people before people are willing to have those kind of conversations. But it certainly doesn't look too hopeful out there. I mean, people would much rather deny that any of this stuff is going on and deal with it.
The argument that if kids aren't taught about sex, they won't do it just frustrates me to death.
Right.
It makes me so angry. Mm-hmm. It's such a... I just see so many people with total blinders on, mm-hmm. and it's nicer for them to be able to think that way, but they're doing a lot of people a lot of harm, I think.
Right, right.
I think, when I was 16, I mean, I had turned 17 two days before I started college. So, you know, in essence, I was a pretty mature 16-year-old. I still think, you know, I wasn't sexually active, and I think that a 16-year-old, you know, when that young is sexually active, I think it is a mistake. You know, I don't think, you know, no matter how emotionally mature you are, but I don't think it's some, you know, I don't think that you should be in danger of dying or becoming pregnant or, you know, carrying one of these diseases because you made that mistake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's what's frightening.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, the amount, you know, it's intimidating to walk into a store to buy condoms or mm-hmm. to buy these things. And I think when society, you know, is so, you know, caught up on it, and it's not only the opinion, but that it's so charged, I think mm-hmm. it's, you know, the people aren't, you know they should, but they're not getting the condoms. They're not using the contraceptives because they're afraid they're, you know, the store clerk will know them and
right.
tell their parents or something like that. And so then they're putting themselves at tremendous risk because they're too afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not stopping them from having sex.
Right, right.
You know, and that's, I think, that's the real terror of the situation.
There's a wonderful resource in the Seattle area. I don't know how many of you are from Washington. It's certainly something that's available to everyone in Washington, but the Rubber Tree, which is run by the organization Zero Population Growth, has a wonderful little store where they sell safer sex products. It's, as far as I know, Planned Parenthood and the Rubber Tree are the only places in town where you can get dental dams. But they have a wide selection of condoms, and there's two great things about it. One, as a store, it's run by volunteers, and so people don't have to be intimidated about going in there to buy safer sex supplies, but they also do mail order, which I think is an excellent thing for those people who really, you know, don't even feel comfortable going in there. But I give all of my patients the card with Reverend Tree's address and phone number, and tell them if they don't need it, that they have a friend who needs it or a relative who needs it, and that they should pass that on to people. If anyone's interested in that address, I have that here, and it's on the sheet about with the dental dams. If you want to just pick that up and pass it on, if anybody wants that. The top one there, the address is on the bottom, and their phone number. And I'm sure that they'll send things out to anybody anywhere in the country, but specifically in the Seattle area. They're in the Wallingford district, if anyone's familiar with Seattle, and it's a great store.
Yeah, they run ads in the University of Washington daily a lot. It's like, I think quite often it says, you know, discreet packaging or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's really interesting because I see a lot of women in my practice who are, say, 40 or 50 years old who have recently been divorced and are now, or were divorced a while ago and are now, just now starting a new sexual relationship. Things have changed radically from the time that they were younger, I should say, myself being around that age. And for them, the idea of going into a store and buying a condom, they just cannot imagine it. And so it's really nice to have this kind of resource to offer to them. And I'm just sad that there aren't more places like that around the country that people have easy access to. But it's certainly important. Anyone have any comments to make on the condoms at Holden issue?
Put it in the first aid bucket.
Good idea. Except where are they?
Bottom.
In the bathrooms?
Yeah. Just stick them right in the open, and they're going to be paid for them.
That's probably fine. I mean, they're not that expensive. So, any other comments or questions? Well, I think that's about all I have. So, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
And, if you don't need this information, somebody you know does, so pass it on.